Breadbox Media Programming is brought to you by...
I actually met my wife on CatholicSingles.com, if you can believe that.
Really?
Yes, I had never done that before. Didn't have any problems with dating.
Natalie and Aaron met on CatholicSingles.com after they realized that they needed to find someone who shared their faith. Meet other faithful Catholics on the original Catholic dating site. Download our app today for free. Looking for a way to build daily prayer discipline? Seen the rise in mindfulness meditation, but not sure if it is possible to meditate in a way that's consistent with your Catholic faith? Just looking for a way to breathe new life into your existing prayer routine? No matter what you're looking for, Hollow is here to help. Hollow is a Catholic prayer and meditation app that helps users deepen their relationship with God through audio-guided contemplative prayer sessions. From meditations on the daily gospel, to the rosary, to daily examines, Hollow has something for everyone. Hollow is the number one Catholic app in the U.S. It is free to download and has permanently free content, but you can also check out all of the premium sessions for 30 days, risk-free, by signing up at www.hollow.app/breadbox.
Welcome back to Off the Shelf here on Breadbox Media. I'm your host, Pete Sox, a Catholic book blogger. And this week we have with us Jamie Stewart Wolfe. She's the editor of Teachings for an Unbelieving World, newly discovered reflections on Paul's sermon at the Areopagus. A Catholic convert, wife, and mother of 8 grown children, Jamie serves as a senior editor at Ave Maria Press. She writes a biweekly column in The Pilot and shares the Catholic faith in word and song. She currently resides in New Orleans. You can learn more at her site, www.loavesandfishesministry.net, or follow her on Twitter at @youfeedthem. Welcome to the show, Jamie.
Oh, it's great to be here.
So today we're obviously going to be speaking about Teachings for an Unbelieving World. And I guess, first off, what an interesting book, and not just the content itself, but its entire backstory. It's not too often something like this comes about. How were these writings for this book discovered?
Yeah, so it is pretty fascinating because you don't often get the privilege of publishing a new work by a deceased author, right? let alone someone who is so well loved and holy. So I was attending the Los Angeles Archdiocese Religious Education Congress, which I do frequently for work, and usually editors go there to kind of scout out what themes and talks are popular, what people are looking for. We go to help out our booth, you know, I work for Ave Maria Press. And we also meet with potential authors and other publishing representatives to just kind of see what's going on and get the pulse of where people are at and what they're looking for. And the Vatican Publishing House usually sends a representative to that event because it's a massive thing. You get like 40,000 people coming to that. So I always make an appointment with the Vatican just because they're the Vatican. Yeah, right? But I know that probably in the back of my mind, the things that they're publishing themselves in Italian or the things that they're kind of putting out there and doing are not necessarily great fits for our publishing house or even for our audience in North America. So, you know, I don't go and meet with them with a lot of feeling that we're going to find something great to do together and collaborate on. Mm-hmm. But you never, ever know. And this is one of those experiences where just being in the right place at the right time was a blessing. So I walked over on a Friday morning and met with Fra Giulio, and we sat down and just kind of went through all the books that they were publishing and coming up with in the upcoming seasons. And he turned the page of his little catalog and said, oh, and we have this. It's a new book from Karo Wojtyła. And I said, what? It's what? and he actually said, he actually told me that it was a handwritten manuscript, but also typewritten. So it's a 39-page handwritten manuscript that was literally rediscovered in a drawer. And it was found in Poland, and it was published in Polish the previous October and was going to be published in Italian by the Vatican, but that somehow in this strange time and place, English rights for translation were still available. I cranked into very high gear very fast. and did what I could to shorten that publishing acquisitions process, which is notorious for being lengthy and rather Byzantine. So it was just an exciting moment of realizing that there was something out there that no one had heard of before, that no one had ever read. It wasn't a compilation of previous works. It wasn't, somebody going through and kind of cutting and pasting things that John Paul had said on a particular topic. It was an extended meditation on Acts chapter 17, Paul's sermon at the Areopagus in Athens, which was largely considered a failure in Tyre. Paul didn't walk away with a lot of converts, and we don't have, as you know, a letter to the Athenians in our scriptures. And there's a reason for that, right? There wasn't really a dynamic church community of Christians in Athens. But John Paul seemed to return to this event in church history, in early church history, again and again, and draw from it. And this book is an extended reflection on that encounter. And it's amazing.
Mm-hmm. So as an editor, how does one handle a book released posthumously, as you mentioned, but not just that, but it was written by a person who, one, was a pope, two, is now a saint. Was that whole process a bit daunting for you?
No. I've worked on previous projects where I've edited the works of popes and prayers of popes. So I think that was good preparation. But you definitely want to get it right. So your attention to detail is kind of really there. And you can't do it all. You can't say, I'm going to do this book this week. It doesn't work that way. It's really something that you have to return to when you're at your best, when you're focusing well, when you're not agitated or kind of daydreaming, right? And it's the kind of thing that you really have to make sure in the translation, and we hired, a professional translator, that it still sounds like him. Mm-hmm. That you want to get all the meaning, but you want it to sound like his voice, and it does. I really feel like reading this book, it reads like some of those Wednesday audiences he was so well known for.
Absolutely. Now, most of the time I'm interviewing authors, so you have the privilege of being the first editor I've ever interviewed. So I wanted to kind of get your thought and insight on what is the role of an editor, just a segue here on a little side trail. What is the role of an editor during the process of a book being born and published?
Right. So this is a little bit different, but there are two kinds of things, right? You either have an original work and you're working with a living author, or you're working to license a project from an author living or dead that has been previously published in another language or another place. So, but it's the editor's job is to kind of project manage the process and shepherd a manuscript from manuscript to book through all those levels of process and copy editing and proofreading and design and, should this be soft cover or hard cover? How big should the book be? What do we need in terms of a foreword or an introduction? What do we want to look at in terms of covers? So it's really kind of bringing all the pieces together, and then you're responsible for that kind of seamless whole that turns up on a shelf in somebody's home or in a bookstore, and that's that's kind of the job of the editor, is really, and then, you know, when you receive a manuscript, you do edit it, right? If it's a living author, you work back and forth. So you're both really happy with how it is. If you're working with a project like this, you're looking at translation, you're querying words that maybe, you know, feel awkward, and you want to make sure that you're using, that you're faithful to the text because you're using something that's eminently readable. Mm-hmm. And just kind of go through that, but, and also contacting people for introductions and forwards. So in this book, I was privileged to work with George Weigel and Scott Hahn. So, you know, you can't get better than that, right? Mm-hmm. You know, you have the whole historical context of the book by George Weigel, and you have the kind of all this deep scriptural background to this chapter in the Acts of the Apostles by Scott Hahn. And they're both great contributions for readers to ponder.
Absolutely. So can you give us an overview of what this book consists of?
Yeah, it's 13 short, and by short I mean like 1,500 words, not a lot of words. You know, a usual newspaper column is maybe about 600 or 700, so about two worth of those. 13 brief teachings that unpack this sermon of Paul at the Areopagus in Athens, as recorded in Acts 17. And that sermon is very interesting because it's the only sermon in the scriptures that we have recorded of Paul preaching to Gentiles, to non-believers. And there it is. You know, we have lots of Paul's writings, but Luke recorded this this encounter, this event, with great detail. And we see in it all kinds of themes that John Paul picks up and really explores. And, of course, what we see, too, is, you know, you don't just learn about St. Paul. You learn a lot about St. John Paul. And you see in it what he really kind of sets forward as a pattern, as a school for evangelization. And you see all the themes of his later pontificate. He wrote this while he was Archbishop of Krakow for only 2 years. And right at the close, we believe, we don't know exactly when it was written, but we have a sense it was written shortly after the close of the Second Vatican Council, so very late in 1965 or very early in 66. And it was a particularly interesting moment. It was an evangelical moment for the church, reaching out to the world in a fresh new way with the council. But it was also the 1,000th anniversary of Christianity in Poland, and you know, under communist rule, under Soviet domination. But there John Paul was, you know, Paweł Wojtyła, as a as an Archbishop of Krakow in southern Poland, and, you know, dealing with how to preach the faith and live it in the constraints of an atheistic regime. In an unbelieving world. And so I think he really saw himself as in a similar encounter as St. Paul. You know, it was in that era, in the ancient world, Paul was speaking to people who had not yet believed. Mm-hmm. But John Paul was speaking to people who were falling away from faith, or who had rejected it, or who were ignoring it, or who were afraid to practice it, frankly, under the circumstances they lived with. And so it's a very interesting thing. But you see here, like, he talked a lot about the unknown God and mm-hmm. the mystery of the incarnation, and how love is both spousal and redemptive. You see those themes come up in his pontificate, which is like 12 years later. He was elected to the chair of Peter. So you see the human being in the truth, the human being in freedom, and he uses little phrases sometimes to echo that have resonance with later encyclicals or apostolic letters, and it's very powerful to see the kind of seeds of this pontificate. It almost reads like a preamble to the mm-hmm. pontificate.
Yeah, exactly. We're going to take a quick break. We'll be right back to discuss more of Teachings for an Unbelieving World with Jamie Stewart-Wolf. You're listening to Off the Shelf. We'll be right back.
Have you ever been put on the spot and asked to explain or defend Catholic teaching on sensitive topics such as abortion, same-sex marriage, or the Eucharist? What to Say and How to Say It is a straightforward and practical resource by Brandon Vogt, best-selling and award-winning author of Why I Am Catholic and You Should Be Too. He offers essential tools for articulating even the most contentious aspects of your Catholic faith with clarity and confidence. You can get a copy of this important new book at AveMariaPress.com. Use code TALKFAITH to get 25% off your copy today.
Welcome back to Off the Shelf. We're here today with Jamie Stuart Wolf, the editor of Teachings for an Unbelieving World, the, we'll call it, undiscovered manuscript from Archbishop Karol Wojtyła, who we all know as John Paul II. And we left off last segment, Jamie, with an interesting thing, and I kind of picked up on this as well. The undertonings of, it's almost as if this book is kind of foundational to his pontificate, because there's so much that he writes in here that resonates later when you read later writings of his. It wasn't like anything changed. He still had the same viewpoints. He still had the same teaching methods. And it was almost, like you said, a preamble to his pontificate.
Yeah, so he was remarkably consistent in his thought, right? Very much so. Although you do see it develop and deepen, yes, perhaps over time. But, you know, you have a chapter on the human being and truth, and he talks about our relationship to the truth and what that must be and how that is, how we are created in the image of God with both rational mind and free will. And you see all those things later, you know, in Veritatis Splendor and in Fides et Ratio, you see those things come up. But I think one thing that he raises in this book, and he says it quite explicitly, is that when Paul failed to bring many disciples into the, you know, into receiving the fullness of the gospel of Jesus Christ in Athens, when that did not happen, you know, we have to ask why. And John Paul's answer, in this book at least, is that it wasn't theology so much. It wasn't as much a matter of theology as it was one of anthropology. There was a real divergence between Paul's very biblical understanding of the human person as created in the image and likeness of God and the Greek understanding, especially among the cultural and intellectual elite of Athens, their understanding of the human person as, you know, a soul trapped in a body, as, you know, as wanting liberation from that terrible state of physicality. We don't see that with St. Paul, and we'll never see it with anyone who is consistent with biblical revelation. So that seems to be the real sticking point. As long as Paul talks about Creator, God the Creator, and God the Judge, we're all fine. But as soon as we get into this man, Jesus Christ, who dies and then is raised from the dead, that's where we have a problem. And it's pretty fascinating and very much what John Paul encountered as he had to deal every day with the encumbrances put upon him and the whole church in Poland by atheistic communism. You know, you have an ideal communist man who doesn't look anything like biblical man, even less like, you know, Christian biblical man. And then we have our world, right, which is also not so much a believing world. It's an unbelieving world as well, where our anthropology, our understanding of the human person is quite distorted. So it's all very fascinating. And he quotes liberally from the Vatican II document, which is also a pretty interesting thing here.
You know, I guess I'm a big picture thinker, big picture looker at things, I guess you want to say that. That's a way to word it. So why now? You know, I firmly believe things happen at a certain time for a certain reason. How do these writings that were mysteriously found in the desk drawer, I know why you jumped on it, because of who it was and the importance of these documents, but how do these writings apply to what we're going through today?
Oh, there are 100 ways I could probably list if you had time. You know, I think especially with all this crazy coronavirus pandemic, and we've now retreated into our homes and our churches have been largely closed for quite a while, we have a chance to reconsider and consider reflect on and prepare for how we will go out back into the world. What is that world like? What are the people who live in it like? Where can we make connections between how they see things and the gospel of Jesus Christ? What are the seeds of the Word of God in our culture? What are the altars to unknown gods that are really out there, and yet we haven't quite yet identified them? In that homily that Paul gave in Athens, he identifies an altar with an inscription to an unknown god, and he makes use of it. Mm-hmm. What are the things we could make use of? Without condemning the dominant culture out there, and even, you know, aggressive, I would call it aggressive secularism, we need a book like this to kind of give us that larger historical perspective and say, okay, so where are we? Well, okay, we're in an unbelieving world. How do we deal with that? Well, we can look to Paul, and we can look to St. John Paul. Mm-hmm. And this book does both. So it's very timely, and it's hard to imagine, it's hard to avoid the conclusion that it wasn't somehow hidden away for 50 years for a reason.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely. You know, one thing you pointed out there kind of leads me into another question. You know, we're detached from our parishes. We can't attend in-person masses in most places. And those of us where the states are starting to open up are seeing a new way of the liturgy being performed. What can we do while we're in this state of remoteness from the church to ensure we don't cave to the idols that Paul and St. John Paul II speak about in this book?
Yeah, so, you know, it's I think a lot of it is really awareness and having the courage of convictions. Of course, you can't have the courage without the convictions, right?
Mm-hmm.
So we've got to nurture our own faith. We've got to stand fearless and unafraid as John Paul did himself and as he counseled us to do, not because there's nothing to be afraid of, but because in Christ we can face all things, all obstacles. We can, you know, show up at the heights of elite institutions and respected people, and we can, in fact, proclaim Christ crucified and raised from the dead. The question is, how can we do that? And how can we do that in a way that is fruitful, not just in a way that's faithful, but both faithful and fruitful, right? So that's I think, the challenge. And we talk a lot in the last year or so, a lot about enculturation, the gospel. You know, at what point does that enculturation, you know, stop being enculturation and start being heresy, right? So, you know, that's something we all ought to be concerned about. But at the same time, can we bring the gospel into the world that we live in as it is? And the answer has to be a resounding yes. There's an evangelical imperative here in the life of John Paul, and certainly in the life of St. Paul, that we share in. It's the call to bring the gospel. That's why church exists. So let's be church.
Yeah, that's a great, great line there. Let's be church. So the other thing he talks about a lot in here is truth. And boy, is that a tough topic nowadays. Discerning what truth is and what is not. What can we learn from this short book about discerning truth?
Right. Well, I think what's very interesting here, and it does come into that anthropological question, right, as well as the theological one. John Paul just returns to a Vatican II document, Gaudium et Spes, the Church in the Modern World, and the section 22 of that document, which he very well may have written. So we put that in context. And basically what that little section says in the Gaudium et Spes is this: Christ reveals man to man himself. In other words, apart from Christ, we cannot access the truth of the human person or the truth about anything else. We remember that Jesus didn't say, oh, here's the truth. He said, I am the way, the truth, and the life. And so it's the person of Jesus Christ who leads us to all truth, who reveals the face of God and the face of humanity in all its beauty, in all its intent, right, to be the image and likeness of God, in all its potential. And so that's I think that's what we learn mostly about truth here. Yes, there is an objective truth. Of course there is. But that objective truth has a name, and the name is Jesus Christ.
Hmm. And then he also dives into something here that I think is somewhat of a painful topic for people nowadays, and that's the Eucharist. I think mm-hmm. many of us are missing that. And even as we return to that, and some churches return to that, and we see the new way of again, the Mass being celebrated and how that's going to be carried out, how do we go about welcoming that return, even if it's different than what we're used to?
Well, you know, we have to take, a long view. Take the long view of church history. We've been through persecutions. We've been through all kinds of things, plagues before. This isn't the first, and it may not be the last. We've been through all these things, and the Eucharist sustains us. And receiving the Eucharist, as beautiful and important and actually how used to it we are, right? Receiving the Eucharist frequently has not been the case for centuries in the church. It was often that someone would receive Eucharist once a year or once a month, but not really every week. And so in a way, we've maybe, you know, familiarity has bred a bit of contempt or at least a little ignorance about Eucharist. We've seen those recent polls, right, that, mm-hmm. that tell us that people who receive don't even necessarily believe. But absence maybe can make the heart grow fonder. And spiritual communion isn't no communion. We need to understand that, right? When we invite Christ into our hearts, when we cannot receive him sacramentally, then we are, in fact, receiving Christ. And we are linking that to his body and blood given as Eucharist. So it's not a question of, you know, not being Eucharistically centered. We will always be a people centered on the Eucharist. The Eucharist created the church around it. That's the fact. So that's the historical fact as well as the theological fact. But if we can put ourselves up in that cenacle in Jerusalem, right, we can put that memory of the Last Supper, that gift of the body, blood, soul, and divinity, if we can carry that with us every day, and we can, even though we're not able to receive, we can still be Eucharistic. We can still be communing with the living God through the Eucharist. That Eucharist is his presence in the world, whether we receive it or not. And so we can commune spiritually. That's part of the communion of saints, right? And as well as sacramentally. Obviously, we want to get people back to the sacraments, that's for sure. But let's concentrate on receiving Christ worthily. You know, let's concentrate on receiving Christ fully and attentively and with all our hearts, not just our mouths, you know, not just sacramentally, but with all our hearts as well. We want to make it spiritual and bodily communion. That's the best of both worlds, right? Mm-hmm. Right now, we're starved from bodily communion, most of us. But perhaps we've been doing a disservice for many years all along and not really receiving him into our hearts. So let's do both.
Mm-hmm. Jamie, where can people find the book Teachings for an Unbelieving World, Newly Discovered Reflections on Paul's Sermon at the Areopagus?
You can find it on Amazon. You can find it on Barnes & Noble. And you can find it at AveMariaPress.com. We also offer a free downloadable PDF study guide. And I've been doing video meetings on Saturday mornings for that. We'll be doing Chapter 5 this coming Saturday, and, you know, in succession, one teaching at a time for the next several weeks. We'll be taking a look at that using the study guide that we've prepared for that.
Excellent. Jamie, I want to thank you for spending time with us today, and I also want to thank you for your efforts of bringing this book to publication. It's a fantastic read. Any closing thoughts?
Yes. Yeah, it's been a joy. But, you know, if you have not read Acts 17 recently, go crack open your Bible and do that. And just see what the Lord has to say to you in that very interesting encounter of St. Paul at the Areopagus in Athens. God has a plan for you, and he's going to put people in your life maybe not at your door today, as we stay home and stay safe and all of that, but he will place people in your life that you can bring his word and his salvation to.
Excellent. With that, you've been listening to Off the Shelf. I'm your host, Pete Sox, a Catholic book blogger, and until next time, God bless.
Breadbox Media Programming is brought to you by... Have you ever been put on the spot and asked to explain or defend Catholic teaching on sensitive topics such as abortion, same-sex marriage, or the Eucharist? What to Say and How to Say It is a straightforward and practical resource by Brandon Vogt, best-selling and award-winning author of Why I Am Catholic and You Should Be Too. He offers essential tools for articulating even the most contentious aspects of your Catholic faith with clarity and confidence. You can get a copy of this important new book at AveMariaPress.com. Use code TALKFAITH to get 25% off your copy today. Looking for exceptional coffee delivered fresh to your door? We have the answer. Our friends at Grim Bean Coffee produce small-batch artisan coffee using top-tier coffee beans. The coffee is roasted when you order, guaranteeing the freshest coffee possible. Check out Breadbox Roasts, a new line of Catholic-themed coffees available at www.grimbeancoffee.com/Breadbox Media. Experience coffee like never before.